next presenter is we'll be covering improving water quality and sustainability through collaboration and partnerships, Sean McMahon with the Iowa Agricultural Water Alliance.
Well, good afternoon, and thanks so much to the American Society of Agronomy and Tri-Societies for the invitation to present today. So I'll be talking about some concepts in sustainability and some principles and strategies having to do with sustainable agriculture, what I call sustainable intensification, and also talk about how those play out at the global scale, national and regional scales, and ultimately how they play out in Iowa. And I'll talk about some concepts like continuous improvement as well as sustainability, and really make the point that Iowa is perhaps uniquely positioned in terms of being a great place for sustainable intensification of agriculture to occur. And then finally talk about some different partnerships and collaborations that we're doing in Iowa to improve water quality, which are replicable and transferable to any growing region in the country. But first, just wanted to provide a little bit of background about my organization, the Iowa Agriculture Water Alliance. So we were founded just over 2 years ago by three of Iowa's leading ag associations, the Iowa Corn Growers, Iowa Soybean Association, and Iowa Pork Producers. And our mission is to increase the pace and scale of farmer-led efforts to improve water quality. And we're organized around implementing something called the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, which I'll talk more about later. But first, wanted to talk about sustainability, and you've probably seen this referred to as the triple bottom line, or perhaps the three pillars of sustainability: social, economic, and environmental. And occasionally, this is referred to as people, profit, and planet. And these principles are all interrelated or inextricably linked. You know, obviously, social and economic goes together. You're all familiar with the term socioeconomic. And certainly, the economy and environment are inextricably linked. You know, it used to be that the old frame was that the environment needed to be exploited in order to make economic gains for extractive industries, you know, things like mining or perhaps forestry. And increasingly, you know, it's being recognized that communities and areas that have healthy environments are more likely to have healthy economies. And certainly in terms of long-term prosperity, when looking at sustainability and wise use of resources, it's really evident that the economy and environment are inextricably linked, in the sense that if we take care of our environment, that's good for the long-term health of our economy and indeed the survival of our very species. So I wanted to share a quote with you from the Brundtland Commission. Gro Brundtland was the Prime Minister of Norway, and she was commissioned by the United Nations to look at this issue of sustainability. And this is where sustainable development was first defined, as meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And I really think this sums it up very well. But the key concept here is not compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And we'll come back to that a little bit later. But one of the greatest challenges that we have, really of, you know, this entire generation and any recent generation, is how are we going to feed a hungrier world? And you're all familiar with the statistics that it's anticipated that we'll have over 9 billion people by 2050, and that these developing nations, they'll want to eat more like Americans, and so they'll want to consume a lot more animal protein in their diets, and we'll have to produce a lot more grain as a result. You know, by some estimates, we'll have to double our grain production. So clearly there are going to be impacts on land use, on biodiversity, on greenhouse gas emissions, on water quality, water availability. So how can we manage that? But let's start by looking at the footprint of agriculture globally over the last few centuries. So here we have a map of the footprint of agriculture. The red would be cropland, and the yellow would be pasture. So this is 1700, pre-industrial revolution. And then watch as we fast forward three centuries how agriculture has transformed the globe. And I'll just toggle back between those. You know, it's really amazing how in a relatively short time, over a few generations, how agriculture has become the dominant land use on our planet. And then projecting ahead, based on figures from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, we're actually going to lose an additional 300 million acres of natural areas that will be converted to cropland by 2050. And if you look at the map, and if you look at, say, sub-Saharan Africa and South America, and also Southeast Asia, you can see a lot of the development is going to be happening there. You know, in tropical and subtropical forests like the Amazon, but also in grasslands like in sub-Saharan Africa, in the savanna, and even in North America, you know, in Canada and the Dakotas. So that brings us to this concept of sustainable intensification. You know, how do we nearly double food production while still protecting the lands and waters on which all life depends? So clearly we need to increase production on our current row crop and pasture acres. And we also need to, where possible, minimize agriculture expansion into natural areas. So we'll talk a bit about some of the concepts of sustainable intensification of agriculture. So avoiding and minimizing that agricultural extensification or expansion into pristine natural areas or critical habitats. Also minimizing the impact of agriculture on water, both in terms of water quality and water availability. All while increasing productivity on our current cropland and rangeland. So here are some strategies regarding that. Production systems around the world must intensify, but that intensification must be sustainable. And we'll talk later about how to measure that. Certainly adopting conservation practices or best management practices of various kinds. Increasing yields on current cropland and rangeland, minimizing that extensification or expansion of agriculture into natural areas, but recognizing that some of that ag extensification must occur. Wherever possible, trying to target that to areas that have already been developed, you know, so bringing back marginal or degraded agricultural lands back into production. So one way that that we know we're going to help to feed the world, and that you know, growing number of people coming to dinner in 2050, is by improving yields through both access and use of fertilizers and irrigation. And we've already seen a lot of positive progress in this area in recent decades. And another very promising strategy that we've already seen put into play, particularly in the U.S. in recent decades, comes out of precision agriculture and greater use of precision in the application of inputs, especially in terms of water and fertilizer. And I've got a chart which shows how water use as well as fertilizer use has been increasing in recent decades. So if you look at the blue line, this shows nitrogen use globally increasing about 800% between 1960 and 2000. During that same period, phosphorus use increased by 300%, and water use increased by about 700%. So I'm in no way suggesting that this is the wrong trend line. You know, as fertilizer use and water use expanded, we were able to feed more people and, you know, make sure that, you know, during the Green Revolution, hundreds of millions, if not billions of people avoided starvation. However, you know, I would suggest that we could still have more improved fertilizer use efficiency. And we have been making progress on that in the U.S., as we'll discuss in a moment. But as that fertilizer use expanded worldwide, so did the hypoxic areas around the world, from only about half a dozen in the 1950s to hundreds today. So there have been some consequences which in part are related to the increase in fertilizer use. But on the positive side, in the United States, throughout the Corn Belt, farmers have been much more efficient at their fertilizer use efficiency. This chart here shows that between 1980 and 2014, if you look at the maize-colored graphs, that almost, you know, astonishingly, yields increased by 114%, just a phenomenal increase in a very short amount of time. Now, much of that did have to do with fertilizer use efficiency, but it also had to do with biotech and other advances. If you look at the fertilizer use during that same period, and this covers NPK, that only went up 4.5% during that same period. So if you combine those two numbers, that yields 105% increase in efficiency. So to put that in other terms, in 1980, it took about 3.9 pounds of NPK to produce a bushel of corn. And in 2014, it only took about 1.6 pounds of NPK to produce that same bushel. So certainly precision ag and the improved agronomic advice that farmers are receiving from CCAs has been part of that improvement. There's still room to do even more, but that has been a real shining success story here in the U.S. And this is a story of continuous improvement. And next, I want to build on our last speaker's remarks having to do with field to market. And there's another great story of continuous improvement for American agriculture there. As we heard from the previous speaker, field-to-market is a sustainable agriculture supply chain initiative, and it represents the major commodity crops in the U.S., so corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, rice, and potatoes. And there's some other crops that have recently come on board as well, like barley and alfalfa and sugar beets. But field-to-market puts out a report every 5 years called the National Indicators Report. And they measure various environmental metrics, which are represented in the field print calculator, which Todd showed in the last presentation. And the National Indicators Report really tells a great story of continuous improvement on all those environmental metrics or environmental indicators for all six commodity crops. And that's really driven by the improvements in yield. And it's measured in terms of efficiency per unit of production. So it's measured in terms of the bushels. But the National Indicators Report also tracks another thing, and that is the total resource use or impact. And as you're talking about sustainability, it's very important to keep that in mind, because that speaks more to sustainability as opposed to only continuous improvement. And that's really been a more complicated story over the last few decades. But here we look at corn, and if you look at the so-called spider graph, you can see the blue pentagon shape represents the five-year average of the corn sector from 1980 to 1984. And then you can see the different colors as the years progress up to the red pentagon, 2007 to 2011, and you can see the footprint of agriculture shrinking. And this is the direction you want to go as you're having continuous improvement and sustainability. So the environmental metrics for land use, soil erosion, irrigation use, energy, and greenhouse gas emissions have all been declining in the corn sector. If we look at soybeans, it's really quite similar. You know, for all those environmental metrics, there's been great improvement between 1980 and 2011. But let's also consider the total impact use. So if we take a closer look at the soybean sector in terms of soil erosion, you'll see on the left for the total that there actually was an overall decrease during the period, but there was a very slight increase during the last decade, particularly after about 2006. And that coincides with millions of acres of land coming out of the Conservation Reserve Program and being put back into production. So as a result, there was an increase in soil erosion in the soybean sector. However, if you look at the per acre measure, you can see it is flatter towards the end and also declines during the entire period. But if you look at that intensity measure per bushel, because yields have gone up substantially, you can see it really declines throughout. So the per bushel or intensity metric tells a more flattering story of continuous improvement, but it's very important to also consider the total impacts. So I would suggest that continuous improvement data is extremely useful, and it has told a great positive story about U.S. agriculture over recent decades. And that's particularly important if you're looking at the field scale of an individual field or farm operation, and also the national scale. But if you're going to talk about sustainability, it's really important that we talk in terms of conservation outcomes around priority resource concerns. And those considerations really hit home at the landscape or watershed scale, you know, or you might argue at the mill shed or growing region scale. So it's very important to talk about those outcomes. And for soil and water, we really need to consider the long-term sustainability and think about, you know, the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. As we heard from the last speaker, you know, we've seen soil erosion occur at 28 times faster rates than soil is created or restored. And we've lost in the upper Midwest about half of our topsoil over just a few generations. You know, if you consider, you know, certain aquifers that are being depleted, you know, at pretty quick rates, you know, what is that going to do for future generations? So continuous improvement is very important. We need to be focused on the outcomes. And one metaphor I'll share with you is, you know, if I'm driving a car and I suddenly realize I'm about to go off a cliff at 60 miles an hour, and I apply the brakes and I only go off the cliff at 30 miles an hour, that's been continuous improvement. However, you know, the outcome is really the same. So when we're thinking about sustainability, we really do need to take that long look, you know, and consider the impacts on future generations, particularly when it comes to soil and water availability. But next I want to shift to water quality, which the Iowa Agriculture Water Alliance is focused on, and talk about water quality at the national scale. And then we'll talk about the regional and state scales as well. But nationally, according to EPA, we have 100,000 miles of rivers and streams with excess nutrients. And within the U.S., we now have over 160 hypoxic areas. And nutrient pollution or excess nutrients is found in 27% of stream miles to have high nitrate concentrations and 40% of stream miles to have high phosphorus concentrations. And let's take a look at the regional level throughout the Mississippi River Basin. If you look at the upper Mississippi for wadable streams, slightly over half of our streams have excess nitrogen. If you look at phosphorus, however, It's less than a quart. And I'd like to point out how farmers in Iowa and throughout the Corn Belt have really made phenomenal progress at reducing their soil erosion. You know, yes, they could do more, but in 1980, the average acre of Iowa farmland was losing 7.5 tons of soil per acre. Today, that's down to 5 tons per acre. Now, it's still not sustainable. We're still losing soil, you know, faster than it can be formed. But at least we have continuously improved on that very important metric. So farmers really have been, you know, heeding the call that went out decades ago to reduce soil erosion, and we've seen so many more terraces and grass waterways and buffer strips and no-till and strip-till. And that really has had an impact on that. Well, more recently, the conversation has turned to nitrate concentrations and the harmful impacts that that can have, particularly on the Gulf of Mexico and the hypoxic zone. We've pioneered some new practices that are really effective at reducing nitrate concentrations. We're just at the early stages of scaling those up. So this is why that's important. You know, this is a conservation outcome, the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So you're probably all already very familiar with this, but excess nutrients contribute to the generation of algal blooms. Then when the algae die off, that takes oxygen out of the water column, so much so that it makes it nearly impossible to sustain aquatic life for species like fish and shrimp. So we have a strategy which emerged. This slide just shows where throughout the Mississippi River Basin most of the nitrogen and phosphorus is coming from. And Iowa happens to be among the top three states of nitrogen contributors and among the top 7 states for phosphorus contributors. But we have a strategy that emerged in 2008 called the Gulf Hypoxia Action Plan. And the best available science suggests that if we're able to reduce our nitrogen and phosphorus loss by 45%, then we'll be able to shrink the size of the Gulf Hypoxic Zone from its current 5-year average of about 6,000 square miles by 2/3 to only about 2,000 square miles. So we now have 12 different states that have aligned around those goals of 45% reduction of nitrogen and phosphorus loss. And one of them is Iowa. And as I mentioned, we're very much organized around implementing the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, which is led by IDALS, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, the Iowa DNR, and Iowa State University. Now, to successfully meet those very ambitious goals, it's going to require transformational change. Different scenarios exist for implementing the strategy, but one that calls for a combination of infield and edge-of-field practices puts the price tag at about $4 billion. And that's quite a lot of money. However, when one considers that agricultural lands in Iowa are worth over $230 billion, that really puts it in perspective. Now, unfortunately, our water quality challenges are very complex, and no single conservation practice is going to achieve those goals for us. But the good news is that we have dozens of tools in the toolbox, and while there may not be a silver bullet, there is silver buckshot. Thanks to Iowa State, we have quantified just how those different practices will reduce nitrogen and phosphorus loss and by how much. But we have to accelerate the rate of adoption of those practices. So I wanted to talk about Iowa and the scale of agriculture in Iowa and really argue how Iowa is a great place to put this concept of sustainable intensification of agriculture in action. So Iowa is about 36 million acres in total. About 30 of those, 30 million acres are in agriculture, and about 23 million of those acres are in row crops. You know, roughly 13 million acres per year for corn and roughly 10 million acres per year for soybeans. But if you look at just those 23 million acres and what Iowa is able to produce on them, it's really astonishing. If Iowa were its own country, it would actually be the fourth largest corn-producing country in the world. And on those 23 million acres, or if you just look at corn, about 13 million acres, Iowa produces more grain than all of Canada. If you consider soybeans, you know, there again, if Iowa were its own country, it would also be the fourth largest soybean producing country in the world. And Iowa produces more soybeans now than all of Canada. So the scale of agricultural intensification is really quite large in Iowa. And when you consider that Iowa, you know, is really, you know, has had agriculture for some time, you know, we unfortunately have lost the majority of our prairie and wetlands, Iowa is an ideal place to boost production on our current acres so that we don't have to see as much expansion of agriculture into other places, pristine natural areas like the sub-Saharan Africa or Amazon or the Cerrado in Brazil. But that has come at a bit of a price, and that has to do with land use changes. You know, Iowa used to be more diverse in terms of the crop rotation. This slide here shows land use over a very long period from 1866 to 2010. And it shows corn, soybeans, but also hay, pasture, and small grains like barley, oats, rye, and sorghum. And if you look at the top chart, that shows corn, and there has been a steady increase since about 1950 of approximately 3 million acres, so 3 million more acres of corn. If you look at the next line, which is the brighter green, that shows the increase in acres in soybeans. And if you look from a period of about 1950 to 2010, there was roughly a 9 million acre increase in soybeans. So where did that increase come from, those 12 million more acres of row crops? Well, they came from pasture and small grains. And so that really has transformed the hydrology of Iowa. According to ARS, the Agricultural Research Service, not having those perennial plants and those small grains, which are sometimes called sod crops, taking up water in the spring, that's put about 7 inches more water into our streams in the spring since 1950. So land use changes have had an impact and have exacerbated some of our water quality challenges. One thing I wanted to talk about was our monthly precipitation pattern in Iowa and how important it is to have cover crops to help address when we get a lot of rain in the spring, either before the crops are planted or before they're established, and also when we get a fair amount of rain in the fall after crops are harvested. So those are the times when our soil is most vulnerable to nitrate leaching or loss. And cover crops is a very key strategy for Iowa and other Midwest states, because if we can establish that continuous living cover and get cover crops either drilled in after harvest or flown in or applied with high clearance equipment, you know, just before harvest, then we'll be able to have that establishment. We'll have those living roots in the soil. Certain species are very effective at scavenging for nitrogen, like winter rye, for instance, and other species are really good at improving infiltration and porosity and soil health. And if we're able to scale up our cover crops, that will really help our nitrate loss. In Iowa, we've done a pretty good job in recent years. About 6 years ago, it was estimated that we only had 10,000 acres of cover crops. This last year, we had 500,000 acres. But to implement the nutrient reduction strategy, we've leased 12 million acres. So there's a lot more that we have to go. But farmers in Iowa and across the Midwest are taking action. This shows some of the conservation practices that we're scaling up. In addition to cover crops, we have improved nutrient management. The four R's are really taking hold throughout the Corn Belt, and that explains a lot of our 104% increase in fertilizer use efficiency. Increasingly, farmers in Iowa and throughout the U.S. are using the right form of fertilizer, applied in the right place, at the right time, and the right rate. Strip-till and no-till, those are very important conservation tillage practices, which also really benefit soil health. Next, we have some edge-of-field practices that are very effective at reducing nitrate concentrations, particularly where we have tiling or subsurface drainage. These practices intercept the tile and then allow denitrification to occur. So things like bioreactors, saturated buffers, and nutrient treatment wetlands, and drainage water management. And finally, we have those practices that are really effective at reducing soil erosion, like buffer strips, grass waterways, terraces, and a new one that Iowa State has pioneered called prairie strips. We're working on one interesting innovation coming out of precision agriculture that really merges business planning and conservation planning, and we got a grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to do this. But different companies in the precision ag space, like AgSolver and Winfield, have been doing work in what we call subfield scale profitability analysis. And some analyses indicate that, you know, for every field, between 3 and 15% of the acres in row crops lose money 4 out of 5 years. So if you look at this slide, it shows the red acres that are losing considerable amounts of money, you know, in this case, over $400 per acre. And so what we're finding is that often the same acres that lose money are also losing nutrients, you know, either through a hydrologic reason or through a soil health reason. If farmers are able to look at this data, it helps them get out of the frame of maximizing productivity on every acre at all costs and helps them get into the frame of return on investment or maximizing profitability. You know, a current, you know, model, if a farmer sees that yield monitor dips, you know, it's call up the CCA and say, hey, what do you have that I can try out this year? You know, any new hybrids, or maybe we'll go higher population in our planting, or maybe we'll go higher rate for fertilizer, but we have to fix this spot. We have to boost productivity. Well, when armed with the economic data from yield monitors, you know, farmers can realize pretty quickly that it's in their own economic self-interest to actually take those acres out of production and put in conservation practices. So that's how we're merging business planning and conservation planning. And here's an example of one field which had a sandy ridge in it, where when taking out the acres that lose on average $250 or more, you see profitability increase from $47 per acre to $76 per acre, and also the standard deviation of profitability decreasing by about 50%. So for the business planning, you know, it all starts with identifying those areas with below zero return on investment that lose money and often nutrients, and then doing conservation planning and matching up the right conservation practices for those acres. One other important approach that we're taking in Iowa is the watershed approach. This slide here is of a watershed in the upper Cedar River in Mitchell County, and it's called Rock Creek. It's between 30 and 40,000 acres. And here, a group of about a dozen farmer leaders were convened by the Iowa Soybean Association. And these farmers said, we want to implement the goal of the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy for non-point runoff right here in our watershed. So through watershed planning, they figured out, okay, what practices do we need and where do we need them? So they looked first at bioreactors and where could they be the most effective? And then where could nutrient treatment wetlands be targeted for maximum impact? Where should we have cover crops, which was pretty much on all the row crop acres? Where should we do improved drainage water management? And where should we have improved nutrient management, or MRTN, as we call it in Iowa, maximum return to nitrogen? So these farmers identified the practices, targeted them to where they could be most impactful, and then they figured out the price tag was about $5 million. Well, they actually set a goal to do this within 20 years. So we really think this is the right approach for taking on something as daunting and ambitious as the goals of the nutrient reduction strategy, which are shared by 11 other states in the Mississippi and Ohio River basins. You know, by taking these bite-sized, 30,000 to 40,000 acre watershed approaches with a group of farmer leaders, you can really tackle these issues at this scale. And we're actually applying that watershed approach through the project that Todd mentioned, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program, which was new in the last Farm Bill in 2014. The Iowa Agriculture Water Alliance and Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship are co-leading what was the largest project of its kind in 2016, a really big public-private partnership that involves 46 different partners. 20 of them are agribusinesses, and it aligns $48 million to improve water quality in our priority watersheds throughout Iowa. So these are those priority watersheds. If you look at the green ones, those are the smaller HUC 12 scale, around that 30 to 40,000 acre size, what we call like the neighborhood watershed. And then if you look at the blue watersheds, that's the larger HUC 8 scale. We also are scaling up these different practices that we've talked about, both infield and edge-of-field practices. And we have an innovative component to the RCPP in that we're working with different companies that have made a commitment to integrate the FieldPrint calculator with their private sector platforms. So these companies are going to take the algorithms behind those environmental metrics in the FieldPrint calculator and put them into their precision ag or farm record-keeping platforms. So we have commitments from Agrium, AgSolver, Agronomic Technology Corp, DuPont Pioneer, Syngenta, United Suppliers, and Winfield to do that within 2 years' time. So we're really excited about that, you know, leveraging the private sector to deliver conservation for farmers. This is going to help lower the transaction costs or transaction time for farmers by having more information that can pre-populate the FieldPrint calculator. And since these companies have these excellent platforms that have a strong value proposition for the farmer, this should help us scale up adoption of the FieldPrint calculator. So we're very excited about this effort. Also wanted to talk about another watershed approach in Iowa that really brings together agencies and municipalities and ag groups, and it's called the Iowa Watershed Approach. And the Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management Agency and the Flood Center at the University of Iowa led an effort to secure a grant from HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, as part of the National Disaster Resilience Competition. So they landed a $97 million grant to reduce flood risk, improve water quality, and increase resilience in Iowa's watersheds and cities, basically by funding practices that can keep the water on the land longer. So things like wetlands and ponds, but also those practices like cover crops and no-till and strip-till that can increase soil organic matter and the ability of the soil to retain water. So this will also help to keep farms more resilient in the face of seasonal climatic variability. And here's a list of the many partners in this effort. You can see there are cities like Cedar Rapids, Cedar Falls, Storm Lake, and Dubuque involved in this effort, and Coralville. And that brings me to a platform I wanted to share with you that we call One Water, and we're connected with the U.S. Water Alliance, which started off as mostly big city utilities, particularly wastewater treatment facilities. And One Water was initially an effort to have improved and integrated water planning. You know, how can we manage water better among multiple utilities, whether that's wastewater treatment facilities or stormwater or sourced water utilities? And it's recently expanded to also be about how can we bring more diverse partners to the table to find the most cost-effective ways to improve water quality and manage water. And so it's about uniting urban and rural partners. So Iowa Agriculture Water Alliance led a diverse delegation of urban and agricultural leaders to the One Water Summit last year, and we just hosted a listening session in Iowa for this effort. But there's a lot of attention about conflict between urban and rural partners in Iowa, and there's even a lawsuit where an urban utility is suing drainage districts and counties and ultimately farmers. But I wanted to bring this to your attention because despite the lawsuit attracting a lot of media attention, there's really phenomenal collaborations going on between Iowa cities and agricultural groups. We're actually working on a policy framework whereby those big city utilities will be able to make investments in conservation practices that farmers implement, and then those utilities will be able to get the resulting nutrient load reduction credits and apply that to future permits. So we're working with two of the utilities in Des Moines, the stormwater and wastewater utilities, and also cities like Cedar Rapids and Storm Lake and Dubuque that are interested in piloting this. So there is really phenomenal progress happening. And again, you know, these things in Iowa, they can be replicated and transferred to anywhere in the U.S., to any state, and any growing region. Finally, I will leave you with a quote from Wendell Berry, which I think really speaks to sustainability in agriculture, and that is, what we do to the land, we do to ourselves. So with that, I would be happy to entertain any questions as time permits. That is such an excellent question, and it's a major challenge in Iowa, where over 55% of the row crop acres are now rented. And I would say that, no, we haven't really addressed that, certainly not at the scale that's needed. But one way that we're interested in doing so is that if we can link soil health to land valuation, that will send the right market signals to those landowners to adopt practices like cover crops, no-till, and strip-till, which would improve the soil health on their ground and therefore make that piece of ground worth more at auction. So in Iowa, we currently have CSR, the corn suitability rating, which gives a good snapshot of the potential for the land to produce. However, it really ignores management practices. If we can get a widely accepted soil health metric, you know, build on the efforts that one of the previous speakers was talking about through the Soil Health Partnership with things like the Cornell Soil Health Assessment. If we can get that better validated on Iowa and Upper Midwest soils, one day we'll have that metric, which will send the right market signals to adopt those practices, and that will help us get past this dynamic where the dominant model is the one-year cash lease. And you can see where the dynamic between landowners and farmers would change because they could both manage together towards that soil health metric. And you could even see where there would be deals that a landowner might say, hey, if you increase the soil health metric value because you've increased the value of my property, I'll give you a break on the lease. Or, you know, hey, as long as you keep increasing this metric, you can keep farming my land as long as I'm alive. That might help break the cycle of this one-year cash lease.
Sure, that's a great idea. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Sean. Enjoy the presentation.
Thank you, Luther.
That will conclude our afternoon session. Thank you.